Oh, thank you, Bob, and good morning. My background is in using DNA for medical diagnostics, and I'm going to run through the science behind the forensic use today, although I rather strongly suspect that for most of you this will all be perfectly familiar. Before we jump into DNA, it is worth remembering fingerprinting, which is equally a forensic application of bioinformation. The fingerprint database is almost twice as big as the DNA database, and this remains the cornerstone of much of the police use of bioinformation for identification. And there are certain problems attached to fingerprinting. I claim absolutely no expertise on fingerprinting, but I think you all know that it involves expert judgment rather than simple statements of fact, and that just occasionally, very rarely, but sometimes, those expert judgments are wrong. Now, when we go on to DNA, what do you do? Well, you take a sample, and this might be from a person, or it might be from a crime scene. Remember, the DNA in every cell of your body is identical, so it doesn't matter what sample you have, as long as it contains cells from a suspect or volunteer. It would normally be a mouth swab. And in the lab, you extract the DNA, you put it through a very standard process that's been used in laboratories for getting on for 20 years, and out of that, you get a DNA profile. And this picture shows you how it would appear in the lab, where each of these peaks represents the size of a little segment of the DNA, which is called a marker. There are tens of thousands of these markers in our DNA, and 10 of them have been selected for the UK DNA database, a system called SGM+. And you have two copies of each marker, one from your father and one from your mother. The markers have been chosen for a number of reasons out of the tens of thousands, particularly that they vary very widely between people. So usually the one you got from your father and the one you got from your mother are different, and you get two peaks. Occasionally they're the same and you get one big peak. They've also been chosen because they don't give any technical problems in the laboratory. So that's what you have in the lab. The biological sample, the actual cheek scrape or DNA, is also stored indefinitely, and that's where a lot of the ethical problems that we'll come to arise. So when you use that evidence, what you have on the DNA database is not that picture of peaks, but you have just a series of numbers which summarize the positions of those peaks. Because there are many, many variants in the population for each marker, the chance of two unrelated people having exactly the same profile is extremely small. How small it is depends on whether the particular variants you have happen to be more common or more rare in the population. But it's less than 1 in 1,000 million for unrelated people. It is, of course, more for relatives, and in the extreme case of identical twins, they will have identical profiles. So you can check your crime scene DNA against a person's profile. Now, if you think of the first ever application of DNA technology in forensics, the Pitchfork case back in the 1980s, two girls had been raped and murdered. The police had samples of the rapist's DNA from swabs from the victims, and they asked all the men in the local village to volunteer a DNA sample so they could check whether it matched. Now, note that did not use a database. They simply compared the samples from the individuals with the victim samples. You don't have to have a database to use DNA forensically, but of course it's the fact that you do have a database which enormously increases the power of DNA, and which also raises most of the questions that our report addresses. So once you've got your database, you can do one of two things. You can either take a profile from a crime scene, check it against profiles from individuals on the database, or you can take a profile from an individual suspect, check it against crime scene profiles on the database. And if you get a full match, then you've got very powerful evidence, but not complete evidence. So when you interpret it, if you have a full match, then there's no argument really about whether that is a match or not. However, there are circumstances where judgment does become a bit more involved. And These include when you have a mixed sample, so when you collect the DNA from a crime scene, quite frequently it happens that that DNA consists of a mixture of DNA from several individuals. As long as you have plenty of DNA, and as long as the different individuals have contributed different amounts, there's no problem about sorting it out. That's not always true. Partial profiles is particularly when the crime scene DNA has hung around for a bit and got a bit degraded. And when the lab runs the profile, they don't get peaks from all the 10 markers, as they would hope. It's still a DNA profile, but if you've lost some of the peaks, the match probabilities are nothing like 1 in a billion. Contamination is obviously a big problem one has to look after, particularly contamination within the police and legal system, where you've got samples from suspects and you've got crime scene samples, and you absolutely must make completely sure that you never manage to contaminate the crime scene sample with the suspect sample, and of course there are procedures for that. Very small samples is the real difficult one. The Forensic Science Service have produced a technique called LCN, low copy number, in which they push the lab processes to the limit. And this has been very valuable, and it's the basis of a lot of the cold case reviews. But it does bring up all these previous problems of mixed partial and contaminated samples in particular measure. It's not scientifically invalid, but it does raise problems of judgment, and it is really critical that everybody connected with using that information really does understand what the problems and limitations are and can ask the right questions. Of course, having someone's DNA at the crime scene only proves that either they or an object they've touched was at the crime scene, doesn't prove what they did. Now, there are other things you can do with DNA apart from matching profiles to crime scene profiles. For example, supposing you've got this profile out of a crime scene, you run it against the database and you don't get a match. Well, one of the things you can do then is say, well, maybe there's DNA on the database from, so we say, a parent, brother or son of the affected, of the criminal. Familial searching, you'd expect close relatives to share types, so you would expect that some of those types would be present in the profiles of the relatives. Scientifically, that's entirely valid. We know exactly what we're doing. It obviously raises questions. A lot of people from our public consultation showed that they're extremely anxious about the ability of family searching to improperly reveal family secrets. Now, we think that those anxieties are overplayed. We put a couple of scenarios in our report to illustrate that. It remains true that it is a legitimate subject of anxiety, and Bronwyn will touch on that. Ethnic inferencing. It might be that in that profile, this particular type, 29, is one which is much more common in Chinese than in white Europeans. It can be found in both, but it's much more common in Chinese, and that might be true of a couple of these other types. And from that, the police can be told, well, we think the criminal may very well be Chinese. This is a very iffy statistical prediction. Some people get extremely anxious about this mixing of talk of ethnicity with talk of criminal detection. Again, Bronwyn will talk a little bit about that. Going on to slightly more speculative things, the ladies can relax, but if you're a male criminal, you have a Y chromosome, you got that from your dad, you probably also got your surname from your dad. There are lots of DNA variants on the Y chromosome. They're not part of the standard profile, but you can ask the lab to test for them. And there is indeed a certain correlation between your Y chromosome types and your surname. And it's been shown that that does work statistically, at least for rarer surnames. Won't get you far with Smith or Brown, but there is that possibility. Now we're getting more speculative. When you think of identical twins, who usually look so very similar, and that tells you that your DNA actually determines most of your facial and other physical attributes. If we knew an awful lot more about how the DNA did that, and if we were able to find out an awful lot more from crime scene DNA, then scientifically one could, in principle, generate a photo fit picture of the criminal. research is going on to try to get there. We are very, very far from there. What we can do at the moment is we can say with, I think, 84% probability whether someone has red hair, but we can't say whether they dyed it or are bald. We can make a pretty good stab at their eye colour, and through the ethnic inferencing line of inquiry, you can say something about their possible skin colour, and that's about it. And the final one that our consultation showed people got very worried about, and that Bob has already mentioned, your DNA obviously does contain health-related information. Therefore, people are anxious that when the police have your DNA, maybe they can find out things from it that they that you wouldn't wish them to find out. For myself, I find it quite difficult to know why the police would want to know that this criminal has a 10% greater risk of Alzheimer's disease than the general population, or indeed why they'd want to know that from someone from whom they've taken DNA. But it is something which people worry about a lot, and so because we're a democracy and people worry, then we need to address those worries. So I'm now going to hand over to Carol, who is going to bring this into the